Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. My basket is empty.
Where's all that?
I usually don't try to give too many concepts so that the retreat doesn't become discursive, but maybe I should give some more. Hope I haven't failed you. There's a lot of hidden things in a retreat that one perhaps needs to be conscious that one's developing a lot of wholesome qualities, even though the meditation might be difficult. So, like, I've got a bit of a cold and all that kind of business. It's just living in Canada, living in Thailand too. Actually, they're always. I go to Malaysia and there's all kinds of air conditioning and get a cold there too, 30 degrees outside. And those are just part of being incarnate in a human body. But all the time when we're practicing like this, most people would find to do this at home very, very difficult. Just wouldn't have the time or the energy to come to so many sittings and bear with difficult states of mind and physical dis-ease in the knees or wherever. So, well, we're building a lot of parami, we're building a lot of virtuous qualities in consciousness which change us, I think, and direct our lives into the future. You just contemplate, like, you're all the time we are bringing forth intentions, and very wholesome intentions. Like, so, just the intention to live by precepts for these 9 days, intentions of renunciation, simplification. There's a lot of renunciation on a retreat. You're not in your comfort zone. You're not with your usual friendships and things which help you in daily life, your own diet, your own bed. So this, you're kind of giving up a lot. So anyone who calls this a retreat, you know, it's not a spa. It's not like, it's just some kind of indulgent activity, is it? So there's a lot of wholesome intentions there which don't really, they're not apparent in the quality of your meditation experience, but they are there. They are there, and they're a strength. They're a foundation for enlightenment. When we had the reading from Lompa Liam, and he had an incredible foundation in his own life and in his own energies and in his culture too. And from that foundation, he put forth tremendous effort, and got those awe-inspiring results. So meditation isn't just the experience itself, the quality of peace or compassion or whatever it is. It's all that, those wholesome intentions that we're engaged in. It's things like determination, you know. Sitting for 45 minutes or an hour, and quite often it's just you don't really want to be there. You like to go for a walk or have a sandwich or something, but you are, you know, you stay there because there's a sense of honor and a sense of determination to do this, and that's a powerful factor. It's the intention to reflect on the way things are, to be mindful and reflect on how it all works, and how do you meditate, and how do you keep your mind in the present moment? And what are the hindrances that are coming up for me right now? And how do I put more energy into dullness? Or how do I let go of worry and all the rest of it that we're constantly practicing with intentions and contemplation and reflections? Well, those carry on in the rest of your life, because the capacity to be present, the capacity to reflect on cause and effect, the capacity to make mental choices about what's going on in your mind, all of those are being enhanced in a very wholesome way, in a very, very good way. Huh? So those are things which need to kind of, you need to maybe try to remember. And if one's just judging the retreat at the quality of the meditation, then it can seem whatever, you know. But usually it can seem disappointing. Sometimes it's peaceful, oftentimes it's not. But that's neither here nor there. It's all that, those good, wholesome intentions which are building a foundation for enlightenment, for freedom, for peace. Lompo Liam, the reading I had, Lompo Liam he's an interesting man. He had a grade 4 education. And then he's come from a farming family, I think about 7 kids. His sister is a senior nun in one of the Ajahn Chah monasteries. And that part of Thailand, northeast Thailand, and if you look at a map of Thailand, it's the kind of bump above Bangkok, top right. It borders Cambodia and Laos. So Chiang Mai is due north. Whereas northeast Thailand, they call it the Isan, is on top right there. And Ajahn Chah Saro, who was an English monk in Thailand, and an excellent monk, and his Thai is now, he doesn't have an accent. He says he thinks in Thai when he's with Thais, and he's an excellent teacher and much loved. And he did the definitive biography of Ajahn Chah after Ajahn Chah died. He did it in Thai. So it is an Englishman that did the definitive biography, which is interesting. And in that, in the introduction to that, I think he says it there somewhere, he says it, he makes a very interesting point, that if you were to judge a country, you could judge a country by its GDP, or you could judge a country by other value. And if you judge a country by the number of enlightened beings that it's produced, then the Isan, the northeast of Thailand, is a superpower. And out of the northeast of Thailand, we have a whole range of very accomplished and much-loved monks, such as Lompo Man, you might have heard of, Lompo Mahabua, Lompo Cha, Lompo Wan, Lompo Phan, and Lompo Liam, and Lompo Samedo, and so on. So there's this for some reason, northeast Thailand produced all these great masters, and the culture there was it's much different now than in my day. it's much wealthier and much more influenced by Bangkok culture. But in when Ajahn Chah was there and when Lompo Liam was younger, there were lots of forests still, so the forest monks could wander. And we come from a kind of wandering tradition where monks are trained in a monastery for a certain number of years, and then they wander and seek other teachers and live on the edges of villages and live very kind of austere lives. And then they do that for some number of years, and then eventually they go back to usually their home village or somewhere nearby, or some where they get an invitation and they start a monastery, and then they teach again. So there's a period of training, a period of... It's very much actually like the craft guilds of medieval Europe, where the apprentice did a 7-year apprenticeship, and then he was a journeyman, and then he could become a master and set up his own shop. very similar structure to that. And so Northeast Thailand has it's actually Lao in culture. It used to be more Lao, so the language is different than Bangkok Thai. And tremendous faith. People have tremendous, tremendous faith. It's just so inspiring to see. And as I was saying earlier, because of that faith, a few young people are inspired to actually take up the training and go for it. Really go for it. Now, in Ajahn Chah's time, there were actually not many options. There was farming, and to get an education was hard because the villages were isolated. So one of the inspiring things a young man could do, or even a boy could do, would be to pick up the robes. And so it was a kind of very heroic and manly thing to do, to take on an ascetic practice and really work hard on the meditation. So you imagine if you had some kind of models like that in our culture, where where young men or boys had a manly image of the Arahant, like, and took up that calling and worked as hard as Wayne Gretzky or Usain Bolt or someone like that. And there are you can have some young men, but in Thailand, Northeast Thailand, it's much, much stronger. The things have changed a lot, and there's more wealth in the monasteries, and there's more... Wealth is always difficult for monasteries. It's not good for monks to be wealthy. It's not healthy for monks to be wealthy. And in... So much of the like the monks that I trained with in Thailand in those early years, they were from farming backgrounds. Very few had any kind of college education. Now there are monks who have been educated in Bangkok or so on, and they've been inspired to join the monastery. So there's a greater range of Thai monks now there. Very good, actually. But the monks that I trained with, mostly from farming families, and they were very strong. Their capacity for endurance, whoa. Because they came from very poor backgrounds, subsistence agriculture. It wasn't the poverty which was grinding. They had enough to eat, but they didn't have any excess, and then they didn't expect anything, really. So the capacity to endure and meditate and sit and bear with the heat and bear with malaria and bear with typhoid and all of that. Very impressive. Very impressive. So the basic medicine, if you got sick, was endurance. I never saw a Thai monk who had hypochondria. Never. I mean, selection of diet? Forget it. It's just this is it, this is it. And it was a kind of simplicity which you can't impose that kind of simplicity on a more wealthy culture, because it doesn't really work. It's false. But that's the kind of simplicity I was trained in. And so the friendships that grew up, that I grew into in those monastic settings, were they're kind of quiet friendships of common weal, is that the word? A common effort and common striving for the goal. In a sense, that's true here too. I'm sure you're all almost enlightened, right? And your mind's all blissed out and so on. But just kind of supporting each other by coming to a sitting and by just trying to be here and do the work and practice noble signs as much as possible. That's a development of Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, which is very important in Sangha life, isn't it? Very, very important. That sense of, like, when, like, say, in monastic life, the robe is such iconic and iconic in the old way, I think, rather than icons become such a trivialized word now. But anyway, and like the robe is such a powerful symbol in Buddhism. And so, like, if I see another monk, the robe is just such a, it's a great reminder of the practice, of the training. And so we, by kind of doing this work together, we really do support each other. That's Kalyanamitta. We support, we help each other in that way. So just, you know, I think you all find that, don't you? See just someone who just is a rock, right? Just sits there, you know, kind of. And you see that, you say, well, yeah, I'll do 10 more minutes. Right? I'll try a bit harder. Very helpful. But don't, you know, you don't know what's going in the rock's mind. So be careful not to project the halo onto them. But Kalyanamitta is, yeah, it's a kind of a spiritual friendship which sometimes doesn't require, you know, kind of a lot of sharing. Sometimes there's a lot of sharing, but just that, just that someone doing the work, being honorable, being moral, and just working at the practice is a very, very good way to be a friend to someone, even if you don't know them. Sometimes it's better not to know them. yeah, I have a nice memory from my second year at Wat Vaponga. We'd get up very early. Maybe, I think, the morning meditation was 3 or 3:30. And I mean, it sounds appalling, doesn't it? But actually, because it was so hot, we did a lot of nighttime practice. People were very, very diligent. So you get up, I guess I think it was my 3 or 3:30, but anyway, it's probably, I should say it's 3:30. And I practiced a lot with a monk whose name is, his name was Anando. He died subsequently, but he was a very good friend. He's from Buffalo. And he was a Marine. And he was injured in Vietnam and had a bullet through the top of his head. So he had seen some life and death. And he was a very strong man. So we would push each other in practice. You know, we just try to, like, we'd say, come on, let's do another 2 hours. I really go for like 8, 9 hours, sitting, walking, and it was a really good manly effort. A couple of men really, really trying to take up the Ajahn Chah's inspiration, because he would really encourage us and push us. You know, he'd really say, you know, don't just go to sleep when you want to go to sleep. You know, practice a bit more, and so Ananda was a very, very good friend. In fact, he and I, we hadn't been back to see our families for many years. So we went together to Buffalo and Toronto in 1977. And we thought we were going to head back to Thailand. And at the same time, Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Khema Dhammo were in London, just kind of sussing out the Hampstead Vihara. And we were going to meet up with them and all travel back to Thailand for the Vassa. And we got a letter in Toronto saying, would you mind staying in London and helping out with Ajahn Sumedho's efforts in London? And we saw that and said, oh no, no. Because we really wanted to go back to Thailand. But we had a great respect for Ajahn Chah's request, and we had a great respect for Ajahn Sumedho, so we ended up staying in England. So anyway, Ananda was a very, very, very good friend. So this lovely memory I have, you know how you have these lovely memories. It was my birthday, and I wasn't even sure. I can't remember if I knew it was my birthday. You know, it was Thailand. Who knows your birthday? And so, like 3 in the morning, Anando shows up with a hot cup of coffee and sugar. Now, this might not sound significant to you. But first of all, where the hell did he get the coffee? I don't know where he got the coffee. Because, like, I was in one monastery. I saw one sweet drink in 10 months. That was when Ajahn Chah came. It was a Pepsi. Oh, Pepsi and ice. It was like heaven. So it like, where did he get the coffee? Where did he get the sugar? Where did he score the sugar? He would have had to somehow get coffee, get sugar, get up, had to make a fire, had to have had got the water the night before from the well or something like that. Huge effort. How did he keep it hot? And he arrives at my kuti, he says, happy birthday. Stay with me for a long time. Kalyanamitta. You know, and that, you know, that can really carry you for months, that kind of kindness and generosity. So Kalyanamitta is very important, isn't it? You know, we have spiritual friends. And I think like a Kalyanamitta is both like someone that you can talk with, someone who guards you among others. So if someone's putting your Kalyanamitta down, you defend them. You're loyal to them, aren't you? Right? If they ask for 20 bucks, you give them 40. But it's someone also who reflects on Dhamma. It's someone who helps you to see your own conscious experience in a way which is according to Dhamma. Someone who sees it as anicca, dukkha, anatta. So that we're developing too, Kalyanamitta. And this retreat is that, isn't it? Where we've kind of, many of us old timers, all of us old timers, not quite, are kind of coming together again and renewing that kind of friendship, which is very wholesome, very, very helpful. So in Northeast Thailand, we have this lineage of very accomplished teachers whose teachings really, until the advent of recording equipment, was lost to history. No one knows who the forest monks really were before Ajahn. There's some contemporary Ajahn Sao, Ajahn Kao, I think, were kind of contemporary to Ajahn Mun, but before that, there isn't much history of this, of a lineage of forest practitioners. And so Theravada Buddhism, its history tends to come from the texts and the commentaries to the texts, right? Which is, it was always from the urban monasteries more, from the intellectuals, and thank goodness that they have preserved those texts. And of course, I, as a forest monk, I'm not a scholar, and I really don't like that many concepts. I like a few. But I find if I get too many concepts, I just start to doubt. So I've always actually appreciated more oral teaching. I've learned much from Lopa Sumedho or my peers or Lopa Cha and so on. So you kind of wonder, what was the whole lineage of practitioners that goes back to the time of the Buddha, who we don't know about, all the Ajahn Chahs and Ajahn Liams and so on. And then the nuns' order, which actually died out in India. We have very little information about that. So, it's only in kind of recent history now that we have some writings from this different kind of strain of practitioner, because they don't, like from this, the forest monks of Thailand, they can be idiosyncratic. You know, they don't have to speak from the texts all the time. They have that cultural freedom to do that, whereas an academic finds it difficult to do that. An academic monk, he always speaks what they call Buddha Vajana, or the Buddha word, from the texts. And so that's very helpful, very useful. But also, it's quite lovely to get kind of different takes, different perspectives on the basic teachings, because everyone learns the basic teachings. That's the fundamental, and then that becomes sometimes controversial. But it kind of wakes you up. So if you're used to hearing a teaching in one way, and then you get it another way, it's great. You know, oh, makes you contemplate, rather than just say, oh yeah, there's the, oh yeah, yeah, Four Noble Truths, yeah, yeah, I've heard that, that kind of thing. So, there was a teacher called Ajahn Dhun. Ajahn Dhun was born, I just looked it up on my little machine. And he was born in 1888 in Surin. Surin is a province and town in the Isan, northeast Thailand. And he was, I think, he must have ordained around 20. Yeah. And he was a town monk, urban monk, for about 6 or 7 years and got fed up with it because it was just ritual. And he went to Ubon, which is the town, the biggest town closer to Wapapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he started to study there and more seriously, and he met Ajahn Mun. And Ajahn Mun had been... Ajahn Mun was a great wanderer. They could, very hard to pin him down. He was just always wandering. And they're always trying to get him to be the abbot of a monastery, and he'd slip through their fingers. Often to... He spent a lot of time with the hill tribe people in Chiang Mai. But... so he was in Ubon at the time, and Ajahn Dhun was very inspired by him, and reordained in Ajahn Mun's sect, in the Dhammayutta sect, and then himself became a wandering monk for 19 years. And he wandered in the hills of Thailand and Cambodia. And just the time scales of these practitioners, you know, 6 years as a city monk, then he studies, and 19 years he just wanders. And while he's wandering, he's just practicing all the time. Very simple, very austere, just kind of really, really basic existence. It's like the hermit monks of China, right? As you hear about them. So then after 19 years, he was called back to Surin by his ecclesiastic elders, and he was asked to be the abbot of a town monastery, which would have been a challenge. And then he was there for the next 50 years, 49. And what I've read about that town monastery, it was a bit of a zoo, right? All kinds of stuff happening. It was also an academic monastery, but you could see that was probably not his cup of tea. And yet he just said, okay. And he became the abbot of that monastery. And he was kind of famous because he never gave Dharma talks. Like, oh, how did you figure that one out? how did you get fed and not give Dharma talks? But I think his style, he would have been there for anyone all the time, because these monks are very generous. They're very generous. But I guess his style was more satsang, you know, the style of being with the teacher and just exchanging questions and answers. And apparently his teachings were very brief, but very, very succinct, very powerful. Why I'm saying all this is because I've just got a brief teaching here, so I need to pad it out a bit. So this from Ajahn Dhun. Ajahn Dhun's name, Pali name, was Atulo, and I, when we ordained our monk in Tisarana, I called him Atulo, under Ajahn Dhun. Now this is a different formulation of the Four Noble Truths, and when you hear that teaching again and again and again, so you have, there's the Noble Truth of Suffering, right, dukkha satcha. There's noble truth of the cause of suffering, samudaya satcha. There's the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, dukkha nirodha satcha. And there's the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, magga. And that noble truth of suffering has to be understood. The noble truth of the cause of suffering has to be abandoned. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering has to be realized, and the path has to be developed. Buddha says this then, the noble truth of suffering has been understood, the noble truth of the cause of suffering has been abandoned, noble truth of the cessation of suffering, has been realized, and the path has been developed. So that's the 12-factor formulation, which you hear many, many, many times. And it's one of those that you should kind of be able to write out for yourself. It's the kind of thing you should memorize and just be able to write it out or type it out. But so that, you know, you know it. You know it in your mind. And then it becomes a contemplative tool. And that's how contemplation works. You memorize things and you read them, you look at them, you memorize them, and they arise spontaneously in consciousness then. And that's how we're trained. We learn lists. We learn them quite spontaneously. And then we remember those lists, we go back to them. Oh, yeah, okay, I didn't see it that way. And so they're kind of standard formulations. Now, the word cessation, and that you've seen that a lot in the cessation of suffering, it's a word that in the Pali is Nirodha. And it's a kind of difficult... Philip and I were just looking up on my machine. These are great machines. They're for study, they're fabulous. So we're looking up Nirodha, and apparently Nirodha is actually it's translated as cessation, so most of you have seen that many times, I think. Yeah, you're pretty used to that. Well, it's actually a problematic word, because as many Pali words are, is that they are used in different ways in different contexts. And English is like that too. So they're like the word dukkha is very hard to translate. The word dhamma is very hard to translate. Very hard to translate. So Nirodha, it's translated as cessation, but it can mean that. So cessation can be like something just decaying and naturally fading out. So feelings of pleasure and pain, they cease just through the natural process of things changing. But Nirodha can also mean when the supportive factors are not there, that's not there. So like when electricity isn't here, there's no luminosity in the light. And that's a different idea than cessation, the light ceasing, as opposed the light's not there when that's not there. Okay, so it has a kind of different nuance to it. Because when you say cessation of craving, cessation of suffering, cessation of craving, so the cause of suffering is attachment to craving, yeah? And then the third noble truth is the realization of the end of suffering is the abandonment, relinquishment of craving. So craving has to be understood, huh? And craving is always really about, if we carry on with that analogy of the rim and the hub, craving is always about going out to objects. So it's about, an object can be thoughts of the future as well as food or something like that, or a car or whatever, right? So it can be mental things. So craving is also about ignorance. It's about me getting something in time, or me not having something, getting, you know, annihilating something, repression, those kinds of things. So craving is defined as sense craving, craving to become, and craving to get rid of. So sense craving is various forms of hedonism, and it's opposite, negative, like wanting comfort, not wanting discomfort, and so on. And then the becoming is all the kind of ego things, of getting somewhere, being someone. And then the vibhava tanha is about getting rid of, annihilating, and so on. So the abandonment of those is the third noble truth. Now when you read a cessation, it sounds like, "Ooh, I got a lot of work to do. This ain't never going to cease." So it can seem, I don't know about you, it can seem like, my gosh, this is a pile of what? And how is it ever going to cease? And because it seems so large. But if you take the other way of looking at Nirodha, and you think about it, when supporting conditions are not there, suffering is not there, that can be a kind of more immediate way of considering it. So then finally, I come to this. There's only four lines. So this was Lumpo Dun's way of reformulating the Four Noble Truths. So the first, and it's in a different numerical order. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. That's the result of the mind sent outside is suffering. So he makes switches, two and one, okay? So the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. Result of the mind sent outside is suffering. So that's the image of the wheel I've been using, right? Third one, the mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. So you switch those again. And that was it. Now that's work for a lifetime if you want. You pin that on your board and just... So, the mind seeing the mind is the path. And the result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. Now Ajahn Sumedho would say that the result of the mind seeing the mind is emptiness. So the way he says that emptiness, the realization of emptiness is the third noble truth. Again, the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. So what's an example? I have a memory of my mom, lots of memories of my mom. And that comes up into consciousness. And not seeing it as a sankhara, as a changing condition, I get involved in it. And I start to think about my mother and that suffering. Now, it's actually not painful. It's actually been some lovely memories. Yeah? But it's suffering in terms of it's unsatisfactory. It's not nibbana. It takes me away from nibbana. And that's the danger of fun thoughts. Right? They can be very, very nice, but there's still a sense of self and me and so on and so on. But so the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. The mind seeing the mind is the path. So what do? The mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. So if you actually do that, then the mind seeing the mind, which is a practice we find in many traditions, awareness of awareness, or witnessing the witness, or mind seeing the mind. Yeah, if you do that, what happens? It happens. Well, I think what happens is first of all, it feels weird. And there's nothing there to look at, really. Everything keeps vanishing. But then you begin to actually notice the whole sense of the doer, the coming and going, the mind seeing the mind. And then you have to stay with it. You have to kind of keep resolving awareness of awareness. The mind seeing the mind. And then what happens is eventually you realize the dissolution of the doer, of the witness, of the looker, or whatever you want. And that's the realization of emptiness. And then you have cessation of suffering. And now why? Because the supportive condition of ignorance is gone. Right? Certainly can come back. So that, and emptiness is of course a word you do find a lot in Buddhism, and I don't know how it's used in Mahayana, but in the Buddhist sense, it's when it's also synonymous with anatta, not self. So when in consciousness, that whole sense of me, the doer, becoming, getting rid of, fighting, struggling, meditating, and all the rest of it, let alone the angry thoughts or the greedy thoughts, just even the sense, this more subtle sense of me, the doer, when that is observed, and that becomes a practice, then ignorance falls away. And so ignorance is always identity, self-identity, ego-identity, the whole sense of me being someone, doing something, becoming something. So to actually then, the mind, seeing the mind is the path. So you pick that up and you just, all right, give that a go. That sounds interesting. Nothing else to do. I'm not getting anywhere with anything else, right? So it's the mind looking at the mind, the awareness of awareness. Now, if you start to think, am I doing it right? then you see, oh, that's the mind, seeing the mind. So there's no way to really think about this one. You can start thinking about it. What is it? Am I getting anywhere? And you just keep seeing the sense of self coming up. And you see it's actually, and you just kind of get a glimpse, you got to get a sense. What? It's empty. No. And then there's a realization of emptiness. The sense of the doer falls away. And then you see that's not suffering. There's no suffering there. There's still conditions, there's still bodily feelings, and still can be unpleasant or whatever, but there's no one suffering because there's no suffering because there's no one suffering, I suppose. That's the way you could look at it. And then as that realization comes into play, that becomes a very very attractive, obviously, very attractive and interesting to contemplate. In that kind of realization of emptiness, that sound of silence becomes quite clear. That kind of background sound that we can hear in meditation, that becomes a kind of quite clear. So maybe try that. Try that as a kind of different formulation of the Four Noble Truths. But if you go back to the traditional formulation, you see how the abandonment of craving is obviously very important. To see craving as an object and not pursue its imperatives or whatever, you know, kind of its pull. And you do, you know, you learn this in little ways, like again, just that, just the initial discomforts you feel in your body, not some gross pain, and you know, then you have to move, but it's just the initial discomforts. That's the arising of craving. Craving will arise, coexistent with that usually, and then you'll quite often get a sense of time. Then, and gosh, it's only 10 minutes. Oh gosh, I hope he does a 45-minute one, not an hour. Sense of self, time, me, and then obviously, okay, so that's taking you out. You believe it, you know, it's a long sitting. It's a long sitting. But then you wake up, oh no, the mind knowing the mind. So you're not just kind of punishing yourself for thinking. I just endure, like those forest monks. But it's much more interesting, actually. Oh, the mind knowing the mind. So then, discomfort, and then what's the condition that creates discomfort as suffering? It's ignorance. And ignorance is always the sense of self which gets embedded in that, which is just a habit. It's just a perception. That's all it is. So the perception of no self, it's not saying that there's nothing there. Your knee is still there. It's your knee, as it were. There's still individuality. But the whole perception of self is a perception. That's all it is. It's empty in that sense. So then the mind knowing the mind, you can see that, ah, yeah, it's that perception of self and me and time. And it tries to gain a foothold, and you're just very diligent, attentive. Tries to gain a foothold, and you're just attentive, and then it may or may not fall away. And then there's still maybe discomfort, or the discomfort goes away. But there's a whole different quality of experience now, because it's no longer conjoined with avijja, with ignorance. So in the Paticca-samuppada formulation, with ignorance as condition, there are avijja pancha sankhara, sankhara pancha vijnanam. So with ignorance as condition, there are sankharas or formations or volitions, and with those kinds of volitions, there is consciousness. And so then in that formulation, you have this word nirodha again. So it says with the cessation of ignorance, there's the cessation of sankharas, and which is the cessation of sankharas, there's cessation of consciousness. Now you read that, when I read that first time, well, oh man, that's it. I'm out of here, no consciousness. Blank. So it didn't make sense. And then it goes on, with the cessation of consciousness, there's cessation of name and form. Cessation of name and form, there's cessation of the sense basis. Cessation of sense bases, well, they're still going on. What's going on? So the word cessation sounds like everything ends, but still, cessation of contact. I'm still contacting stuff. I couldn't make sense of it. But then this other formulation, when the contingent factors of ignorance are there, a certain type of sankhara isn't operating. When ignorance isn't a problem, this is one of the translations Prayuta was giving, when ignorance is no longer a problem, sankharas are no longer a problem. Consciousness is no longer a problem. Contact is no longer a problem. And there's no suffering. That's a whole different formulation. So you can see how contact can be going on, and because we are sense beings, you know, we're always being contacted and so on. That can be going on, and it can be not a problem. And then someone, you know, starts to breathe too loud or sniffle or snuffle or shuffle or whatever, and then the contact becomes a problem. Why? Because I want that person not to do that. I want silence, I want my space or whatever. So with ignorance as condition, contact becomes a problem. And then the mind looking at the mind, so the ignorance is the kind of pulling you out. So the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. You know, when we were in Hampstead Vihara, we had the most noisy place. You wouldn't have believed how noisy it was in London. And Ajahn Chah says, you know, all this traffic, he says, don't go out there and bother the noise. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. Yeah? But then the mind, seeing the mind as the path, so you get the ignorance arising. Oh, why don't they be quiet? You know, they came in late again, I saw them, or whatever you want. And then the mind knowing the mind. And then you see the sense of self right there. Mind knowing the mind. You see the sense of self. And you pay attention. Emptiness. So the supporting conditions are no longer there for suffering. So consciousness is still there. Contact is still there. Life is still going on, but it's no longer suffering. So it's an interesting kind of... Maybe I'll just pin that up somewhere if you want to write that out. It's a kind of nice one. Lompa Sumedho, he's had this carved in Thai in his kuti. He's got a nice plaque carved in Thai, in the Thai language. So I think we're all pretty tired. I'll leave that for tonight.